Montana wildlife commissioners have voted on hunting and trapping rules for the gray wolf. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Reporter Ruth Eddy tells us about this weekend's Missoula Marathon. Reporter Justin Steck shares his experience at the 115th Arlie Celebration in Powwow. And in tonight's feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with Montana Superintendent Denise Juno about some ongoing challenges with the student risk survey. Montana wildlife commissioners have voted unanimously to enact more aggressive hunting and trapping rules for the gray wolf. It's part of an effort to reduce the predator's population, which is still higher than state biologists want. This despite recent hunting seasons after wolves were taken off the endangered species list a couple of years ago. The new rules extend the hunting season, allow more wolves to be taken by individuals, and allow the use of electronic calls. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us the commission did vote to scale back some of the changes after concerns hunting was too aggressive near Yellowstone National Park.
Every single year you think it's going to be easier and there's going to be more agreement, and it seems like every single year we find ourselves in about the same spot.
Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Commission Chairman Dan Vermillion, he says good people on both sides of the wolf issue still disagree on their fundamental management.
This is what we've come up with, and I'm going to vote for it.
State biologists estimate last year the state wolf population dropped for the first time since reintroduction, although slightly. A minimum count of 637 wolves in 2011, dropping to 625 at the end of 2012. Last season, hunters and trappers killed a total of 250 wolves. FWP says hunters and trappers could take up to 450 wolves, and there still would be a viable population in the state. The department says that number will likely not be met, even with the new, more liberal rules. And let's break those down. The 2013 legislature passed a law allowing hunters to take more than one wolf apiece. The rules passed by the commission now allow an individual to take up to five wolves in any combination of hunting or trapping. Hunters may now use electronic calls as well.
Members of the commission, my name is Paul Fielder. I traveled 4 hours to get here.
Paul Fielder comes from Northwest Montana. He's a Montana Trappers Association board member. He says last season was a good year for trapping wolves.
We were trapping an uneducated wolf population, and we had very little snow. So it's unrealistic to believe that we'll have the same or better success for trapping next year.
Fielder supports the new rules. He's glad to see FWP keeping trapping around as he calls it, a tool in the toolbox. The commission received nearly 25,000 comments regarding the new rules online, and a good bit of them had to do with areas around Yellowstone National Park. Montana has no statewide quota on how many wolves can be killed. Many comments, including those from Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wank, say that would too dramatically lower Yellowstone's population. The park's wolves generate a fair amount of economic activity in the Yellowstone region from wildlife watchers, and a few of the park's prominent wolves were killed last year. In response, commissioners amended the new wolf rules to put in a total hunting quota of 7 for management units around the park. In those areas, an individual can only take one wolf. That's still not good enough for Wolves of the Rockies representative Kim Bean.
You take that many wolves in that area, you will take over and take care of and decimate some of these packs. It's not right.
Other wildlife advocates, such as the Montana Wildlife Federation, call the new rules fair. Commission Chairman Dan Vermillion says often the commission is accused of not listening and not accommodating the public comment they receive.
But in this case, I think we really did listen to that public comment very carefully.
The general rifle season has now been extended to a full 6 months, from September 15th through March 15th. That's preceded by a short archery season, and the trapping season lasts from December 15th through the end of February. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, Montana legislative leaders are asking a state senator charged with drunk driving and obstructing a peace officer to temporarily step back from his legislative duties. Browning Democratic Senator Shannon Ogier is scheduled to appear in court next week on 3 misdemeanor charges. He allegedly fled a traffic stop within the Blackfeet Reservation's boundaries after telling a sheriff's deputy the man had no jurisdiction over him. Senator Ogier did not come to today's meeting of the Law and Justice Interim Committee. Senator Minority Leader Butte Democrat John Sesso says he has been in close contact with Ogier since the incident.
Senator Augier and I agreed is that he would be good for him to just be excused from his first meeting of Law and Justice until the matter up there in Glacier County is adjudicated.
Sesso says other Senate leadership, including Republican Senate President, wanted to take more action against Augier. But Sesso says it's far too early for any of that, saying Augier has not yet been convicted of anything.
I absolutely will not tolerate any forced resignation associated with Senator Augier until these facts are adjudicated.
Sesso expects Augier to return for the Law and Justice Interim Committee's next meeting, depending on what the court does find. Senator Augier has not been returning reporters' calls for comment.
President Barack Obama has signed a disaster declaration making federal money available to help the state, local, and tribal governments repair or replace facilities damaged by flooding in north central and northeastern Montana this spring. The declaration, signed today, makes federal money available on a cost-sharing basis for emergency work or repairs due to flooding between May 19th and June 3rd in Blaine, Shodo, Custer, Dawson, Fergus, Garfield, Hill, Macon, Musselshell, Petroleum, Rosebud, and Valley counties, along with the Fort Belknap, Fort Peck, and Rocky Boys reservations. Governor Steve Bullock requested the federal help on July 1st, saying a preliminary assessment indicates the flooding caused $3.15 million in damages to roads, culverts, bridges, water systems, and government buildings. Federal funding also is available for efforts to prevent flood damage.
Since 1898, the Jocko Valley, north of Missoula, has hosted a celebration during the week of the 4th of July. The timing is no coincidence. In the late 19th century, tribes in the area were banned from performing many of their ceremonies, so tribe leaders proposed a 4th of July celebration, thinking it may allow them to continue their traditions. It did. The 115th Arlee celebration was held from July 3rd to July 7th in Arlee and brought together families and friends from across North America. Reporter Justin Steck spent a day at the powwow and shares some voices from the event.
From the time the first buttercup blooms, they're starting to go out and gather roots and all of this for their food, you know, and saving it, drying it. So they work till middle of summer, then they take a break.
That's John Yardley giving some background on early gatherings in the area. For hundreds of years, Native Americans have celebrated the Circle of Life with seasonal festivals. They feature dancers recreating their exploits on the battlefield, or war dances. One evolution of the powwow included tribes moving away from war dances and adopting popular dance styles from other tribes. Arlee says the relationship that Native people had with their environment was one of communication.
So you talk to everything, all the plants that grow, they're all our relations. They were here before human beings. They prepared the world for the human beings.
Arlee says that some of the changes in the powwow are a reflection of the younger generations always craving change. Powwow committee member Sean Dean Pete talks about how that need for change has come full circle, with some local traditions being revived.
Some of the changes that we've made is we started the old style day to let some of the younger people see some of the more traditional dances that are really specific to our tribe.
Pete also talks about some of the steps the committee has taken to ensure everyone's enjoyment.
One of the values that our kind of people have is that when we have visitors come, we try to make it hospitable for them. So we work hard to keep the encampment clean, make sure we have enough security so everybody's property is safe.
The powwow has seen many changes throughout the years. Gene Sorrell talks about one big change he and his wife helped implement in 1984.
We developed a more realistic look at the alcohol and how it affects the powwow. And so we was able to transform that. And so today you see a powwow that is drug and alcohol free. That started the biggest change that I've seen in our powwow.
Sir Earl said the goal was to get the powwow back to being about the blessings we receive. His family openly shares their blessings with many during the powwow.
Sometimes we have 50 to 75 people come through and have dinner and supper with us. It's a sharing that we continue to do, and we like to do it, and it's a privilege to have people come here. We've had birthdays, we've had weddings, and we've had dignitaries.
The term powwow has several different definitions, and powwows mean different things to the people in attendance. Gene's wife, Anna White and Sorrell, is renewed by the powwow and tells how the beginning of the celebration involves mourning those who have passed.
I work where there's where I've come to understand teen suicide in Indian country, so I dance for those young people that died. But then they say, celebrate. And you get to let that go. And so I think for us as Salish, it starts, our next year starts, as they say, celebrate. Kind of feels like, for me, like a recreation of my soul.
The significance of passing on traditions to coming generations was mentioned by many. After grand entry on Friday, an honor ceremony was held for a young boy named Jackson. Dressed in full regalia, he led his family under the floor for his first time around the arbor. They followed behind, carrying two large blankets filled with gifts that they laid at the center of the floor and invited people out to claim. Dancer Ruth Swaney from the Flathead Reservation was at the powwow to be with family and friends. As she put the finishing touches on her grandson's outfit, she talked about dancing.
It makes me feel happy. I celebrate, and in our Salish language, Esiap Kaini means that to be celebrating. I'm just happy to have my children and my grandkids and our friends and relatives, and we are all camped together, and it's something that we look forward to all year long.
Swaney also brought up the question of whether powwows should be competitions where the winner receives money. Greg Red Elk travels to powwows to dance and sell his hand-painted imitation eagle feathers. As he shared his story, his partner painted a white horse and a turkey feather in the front seat of their car.
If you can imagine, if you make anywhere from $500 to $1,000 a weekend dancing, you can't really buy the big house, but you can provide a living. And if you're happy doing what you're doing, arts and crafts, and my wife and I, this is something we do for a living.
Red Elk left a promising career at Microsoft to live a life that makes him happy. It happened after attending a powwow in his hometown.
I remember my daughter was with me, and she was sitting on my shoulders when I was watching the dancers, the ones I knew that I had grown up with. Some of them were out there dancing. I never knew them as good dancers. I knew them as they danced, but they weren't good dancers. But this time, every one of them looked really sharp, and every one of them was in perfect time with the song, and it just did something to me, and I started to cry.
Red Elk was changed by the dancers he saw that day at the Fort Peck Reservation. His story tells the power of native drumming and singing, accompanied by the dancers in traditional regalia. Also featured at the powwow was Stick Game. It's a game of gambling where opposing teams subtly use psychology and guile to outwit each other also while drumming and singing. It's a hard one to describe. Arlie said that traditionally after the celebration, it was time for chokecherries, huckleberries, and harvest berries. And then on to the hunting season. For Montana Public Radio, I'm Justin Steck.
A brief correction on a story we ran yesterday and this morning on cleanup at the site of the Rainbow Family Gathering. We incorrectly reported the gathering was held in Broadwater County. It was actually in Beaverhead County, and cleanup is still going on there. We apologize for the error.
Reflectors, Lycra socks, and Body Glide. These are what 3,500 runners might be using for this Sunday's Missoula Marathon. But as reporter Ruth Eddy reports, a marathon isn't just about fancy gear.
This year, more people than ever will be running the Missoula Marathon. Over 6,500 runners and walkers will be participating in the marathon, the kids' marathon, the half marathon, and the 5K. It's Run Wild Missoula's seventh marathon. Executive Director Eva Dunn Frobig says there will be runners representing 48 states, 8 countries, and a lot of locals.
Usually about 25% to 30%. Of the runners are from Missoula, which is pretty cool that we have so many locals participating.
For the first time, Run Wild Missoula put a limit on the number of runners, but they did it for a reason.
We don't want the race to be too big. We want to have healthy growth and do it gradually so we can keep it a really well-organized event.
Even a well-organized event will get some complaints.
You know, somebody's not going to like that runners are going by their house at 6 in the morning, and I can understand that. You can't make everybody happy, but I think we're making a lot of people happy.
Businesses, too. An economic study they had done last year found that the marathon brought $1.2 million directly to town. The race costs a lot to put on, too, paying for street closures and professional timing. These are things that race director Anders Berger has to deal with, but it's not just him.
It's really put on by volunteers. I mean, it's amazing how many hours volunteers give to an event like this. It's pretty cool.
Needle on that hole, and I find this. Whoops, better get a one I didn't do.
Volunteers like Donna Bennett, who's tagging T-shirts.
And then I pull a trigger.
Bennett is almost 68 and had never run up until about 3 years ago.
I was having a very hard time with what happened to me, and I knew I had to do something so that I didn't get really, really depressed.
Bennett, after being a widow for over a decade, began dating and had her heart broken.
It broke my heart. I mean, he really did, you know. And so I just one day, I don't know why, I said, I'm going to be a runner. And then I got a pair of shoes and I started.
She hasn't found a new boyfriend, but she has made a best friend. On her left calf, she has a tattoo of a stick figure girl running with green wings.
In memory of my first marathon, and I chose a runner girl, but I wanted angel wings on it. Sorry, I get emotional. For my best friend that stayed with me.
She wasn't doing so well on her first marathon, but her friend Carol wouldn't leave her behind. The two friends also have matching tattoos commemorating their second marathon.
It's the turtle, and, turtles are slower. So the back of the pack are slower runners.
Back of the pack is where Bennett plans on being in this weekend's half marathon. Dunn Frobig will be on the other side of that same race.
I have to run really fast so I can get back to be working at my post. I'm usually down at Karis Park.
Frobig says marathons aren't just for runners.
It's really good people watching, and because there'll be people from all over the world there and really fit people.
Registration is still open for the 5K and can be found online at runwildmissoula.org. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Ruth Eddy.
There's some encouraging results in a survey of Montana students, and there's some troubling results as well. A new category for this year is dating violence. Just over 11% of participants reported experiencing some form of dating violence. The Montana Office of Public Instruction released the 2013 Youth Risk Behavior Survey results for Montana high school students. The 99-item questionnaire was developed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It is a self-reporting and anonymous student survey issued by the Office of Public Instruction in February of every odd-numbered year. In tonight's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Montana School Superintendent Denise Juno discusses some of the ongoing challenges the survey revealed. First, though, the good news.
We are able to look at trend data, and so over the last 10 years, we've seen smoking cigarettes has significantly decreased, actually, from 61% to 41%. And so I think that's a great testament to the work that's going on in schools with anti-tobacco programs, other laws that our state have developed, and just the idea that it is not maybe a cool thing to do anymore. And so that was good news, I think, for the youth in our state. Also, drinking alcohol has decreased from 50% to 37%. And so that was also really good news to see as well. And again, it's a credit to, I think, a lot of the school programs and the focus that communities are putting on decreasing those rates.
50 to 37%, that is significant,
yeah,
isn't it? Under that umbrella of drinking, does that include binge drinking as well?
Yeah, and so binge drinking is defined by the CDC as 5 or more drinks on one occasion in the past 30 days. And that actually also decreased from 37 to 24%. And so that was really good news to see as well.
Well, there are some troubling issues here. Mm-hmm. One of them, one of the headline grabbers is distracted driving, texting
right.
And driving, basically. 56%, up 6 points from 2 years ago. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, those are really significant numbers and kind of shocking, actually, to see that large of a number of students or our youth are texting or emailing while driving, and particularly using cell phones in the car while driving. And so it does lead to distraction, and we know that there are a lot of accidents and sometimes fatal accidents that are totally preventable as a result of that distracted driving. So we do have some work to do in that area. And again, I think what it does show is that when we put a focus on risky behaviors, we see it in the smoking, we see it in alcohol use, and now we should move into distracted driving. But it's also adults need to sort of, we need to role model for students appropriate driving methods as well. And so it is something that we'll take a big look at and make sure that we're putting a little bit of focus on trying to decrease that number over time.
And absolutely. I mean, distracted driving is not limited to the realm of teenagers.
No. I mean, you see it all the time, and I know that a lot of cities actually have created ordinances now. Maybe over time we'll see a decrease in adults and students actually engaging in distracted driving. But it is something that, you know, with those types of numbers that we really should pay attention to.
Yep. Okay, bullying is another sore spot. Bullying here means what? In what forms?
Well, it's both. So there are a couple questions. Bullying about physical bullying or face-to-face bullying, but also moving into the area of cyberbullying. And we know cyberbullying is a huge issue, particularly because it can take place anytime, 24/7. It's on Facebook and texting and, you know, all the electronic media that we're all exposed to, but a lot of cyberbullying occurs as well. And again, I think there are some good programs in schools now. They're paying attention. We actually have a new administrative rule for schools on the type of anti-bully policy that they have to have. Previously, the Board of Public Ed basically had a rule that said schools must have a policy. Over this last year, we've actually fleshed that out a bit and said the policy must include these common definitions, they must have procedures, they must be clear, and we've developed a model policy for schools as well if they want to adopt it that fits that new rule. There's a place on our website called Bully Free Montana where we do have that policy. We also put a lot of information on there for students and for families if they feel their child is being bullied or if their child is a bully, about the appropriate kind of measures and where they can go for help.
Given that we hear so much about bullying and that all too frequently we know that bullying leads to some of these just insane acts of school mm-hmm. violence, are you surprised that it continues like this, or is that just a part of, as they say, growing up?
Well, you know, I don't think we should sort of accept it as just a part of growing up. It is something I think that is much more pervasive than it's been in the past, particularly as a result of cyberbullying and those types of instances of, you know, things can happen at 11 p.m. at night on Facebook, and it then follows the student back into school on the next day. And so things that are happening outside of school are certainly having impacts during the school day, and it's a new area for schools to have to deal with. You know, before I think that we could have a focus on things that were actually going on during the school day, but this follows them 24/7. And there's just a lot of work we need to do, and we kind of see the results of that. And yes, it can lead to really bad results and violence that happens, and so we want to make sure that we do as much as possible to learn about how to interrupt that behavior, to make sure that students have access and are able to tell an adult about what's happening in the school if they're being bullied, and just make sure that those processes and procedures are lined out very clearly and available for both students and their families.
And these students were asked a few other interesting questions. One of them focused on dating violence.
Right.
That means what, rape or what?
Well, no, I mean, dating violence would just mean somebody that you're dating and forced to do something you don't want to do or don't feel comfortable doing. And again, it is those types of, you know, relationships that we should be having open and honest conversations with students about. If you don't feel like you want to do something, you don't have to do that. And I think that's the other big thing to come out of this youth risk behavior survey. It does say adults need to start having conversations with students from everything from dating violence down to bullying to cigarette use, and we can't shy away from those types of conversations, and we need to be really open and honest with them.
And I would ask Ms. Juno about how we compare nationally, but the data is not really available.
Yeah, so we'll have that data about how we compare nationally next summer. They are still putting it together at the national level, but that's always interesting to see, too, about where we compare with everybody else as well.
And you've already addressed this fundamentally, but so what then, if anything, can you and your colleagues do to get it through to these students that things like distracted driving, continued bullying, that sort of stuff, just isn't going to fly? What's the process?
Well, I mean, one thing that we would, you know, we had a budget proposal during this last legislative session to increase funding for traffic education or driver's ed in schools. Those costs have skyrocketed over the last few years, and most of the cost now is being borne by families and having to pay upward to like $400 for their student to take that class.
Wow.
And that's really the class where these types of discussions can really occur about texting and driving, the dangers of using your cell phone, of being distracted, and really the rules of the road and just being able to focus on those areas. And the legislature, unfortunately, did not fund that increase. We'll probably take that request back to them, but it is a place in school with a licensed and trained professional that allows students to have those conversations and to learn the rules of the road and know that that's not appropriate. And so those are the types of things that when we look at this data, we're able to take back to the policymakers and the lawmakers and really have a good discussion about where we need to move in the state.
Yeah, but that's 2 years from now, going back to the legislature.
And so in the meantime, I mean, what we will do is we'll distribute this data, we'll talk with schools about it, and like I said before, what we've seen with the decrease in cigarette smoking is just a lot of good school programs that talk with youth, that students organize themselves and take on a campaign and start talking about those issues. And so similar things can happen as a result of this distracted driving data as well.
There's always hope out there for improvement.
Always. You know, it's always a mixed bag when we see the youth risk behavior survey, but there was some really positive trends that we're able to see and celebrate and to learn about areas that we need to put a little bit more focus.
Montana School Superintendent Denise Juno, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Edward.
And in tonight's weather forecast, across all three listening areas, tonight expect mostly sunny skies with lows in the 50s. Tomorrow calls for mostly sunny skies and a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs will be in the 80s. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Kohler.
Good evening. I'm Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, the area agency on aging for Missoula and Ravalli counties. This month, I celebrate 30 years at Missoula Aging Services and 34 years working in the field of aging. Tonight, I would like to pay tribute to all the older adults who have served as my mentors and helped shape my personal and professional journey. I think of a mentor as a wise advisor, and I've been blessed with many throughout my career. In 1979, I started my first job in aging when I moved to Whitefish, shortly after I graduated in the field of gerontology from Kent State University in Ohio. I was a wide-eyed 23-year-old ready to save older people from the injustices they experienced as they aged. As I saw it, they needed me and my energy to fix the issues. I soon learned that not all older adults needed to be saved. Simply living to age 60 and beyond gave a person a certain resilience and wisdom just through life experiences. My approach of assuming their needs and telling them what they were had to change. The first big lesson on my journey could be summed up by the adage, "Seek first to understand rather than to be understood." I also learned the importance of humility. Older adults have given me the benefit of experiencing live history through their stories. I grew to understand and deeply appreciate the greatest generation, those who had gone through the Great Depression as children, fought in World War II, and believed strongly in the principles and morals of their time. This generation experienced more change over their lifetimes than in any other period in history. After the war, they lived in an era of prosperity when jobs were plentiful and companies rewarded loyalty with pensions that guaranteed them financial support until they died. Social Security was created to keep older adults from slipping into poverty and to care for families who lost their major breadwinner. A strong work ethic helped create the communities we live in today. Prosperity brought security and lots of babies, resulting in the baby boom generation. But those few remaining greatest generation members are now seeing a major shift, what I think is the beginning of many broken promises. Their baby boomer children are entering the stage of geriatrics at a time when pensions are all but lost and loyalty to a company is neither rewarded nor recognized. A gentleman's word, once his honor, is now a manipulation of words to get your money. Alcohol use, the demon of their generation, is supplemented by illegal and prescription drug abuse. Leaving doors unlocked and living without fear is a thing of the past. Modern medicine has increased longevity, but over-the-top expenses of living mean many outlive their resources. Some wish for death because they feel they are burdening their families and wasting resources that could be spent on the young. I've learned more about humility through their examples, too. I am continually amazed to work with elders who desperately need services, yet feel that someone else could use it more. Many are concerned that money spent on them will mean less for the children. I've witnessed their fear and loneliness brought on by the loss of a spouse and lifelong friends. I have acutely felt the need for our community to surround the very old and assure them they are not forgotten or alone. After all, they once were young, like many of you. The only difference now is an older face and a life's journey to tell. As I have aged at Aging Services, I have had the good fortune of my older, wise advisors nurturing me through my own life stages. Their words of wisdom resonate now more than ever. Words like, take time with your children because when you look back, it will be a mere blip. Or, don't sweat the small stuff, and it's mostly small stuff. I've adopted a workplace culture that encourages a healthy balance between one's work and home life. I am now embarking on that stage of life when the children are out of the nest and it's time to redefine my future. I look to my older mentors who have shared their successes and failures as I figure out what that future should be. So hats off to all of my many mentors who have taught me so much over my 30 years at Missoula Aging Services. I've had the opportunity to see the future through their eyes, and they have helped me understand that life is not something to rush nor waste. What a privilege it is to have a job that has allowed me to listen to and seek to understand a generation of extraordinary older adults. To them, I owe my deepest gratitude. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, and thanks for listening.
Susan Kohler is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.